Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 252. Greta, what's up?
Hey. Not a whole lot.
Yeah.
Really stoked about today's episode.
You missed a perfect opportunity. I'll tell you what's up.
What?
Birds.
You didn't even give me a chance. I was probably going to say that, actually. I said I was really excited about this episode, and I was going to elaborate, but...
Oh, well, beat you to it.
Birds. Birds is what's up.
Birds is what's up.
Bird is the word. Bird is,
you got that one. On this episode, we'll be taking a close look at the birds of Middle Earth with the help of ornithologist, Tolkien enthusiast, and longtime listener, Jonathan Rice. Before we get started, we'd like to give a double up air five to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Andrew T, John R, and Ms. Anonymous.
Thanks, guys.
Please support the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and land you some awesome perks. You can now make an annual pledge and get 1 month free. And we are now doing bonus content for each episode as we are able to. So that is another thing. So at the end of this episode, if you want more and you're going to want more, you go on over, you become a patron, you get more, right? Works like that. So boom. All right. And subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. Oh, we forgot to do our double up air five. Yeah. Double up air five for our patrons. Here we go. Oh, Jonathan's going to join us. All right. 3, 2, 1. Whoop. Nice.
That was perfect.
Boom. Nailed it. All right. So subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. If you are a 5-star fan of the Tolkien Road, you can really help us out by heading over to iTunes or your preferred source for the show and dropping us a rating and review. When you do that, it helps get the word out about the Tolkien Road, which then encourages us to keep on evering on. So
evering on.
Do it. It's time for the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 for all those watching us on YouTube. One Air 5, unless you're a patron, you already got the two. All right, so here comes your YouTube weekly Air 5. 3, 2, 1. Whoops. Nice. I love the guest participation. Thank you, Jonathan.
So good.
All right. So, for many Tolkien fans, one of the most alluring qualities of Middle-earth is its remarkable verisimilitude, or in other words, the way it impresses itself upon you as being real. Indeed, Tolkien's meticulous attention to detail makes his works evergreen, fathomless, and rich. Earlier this year, longtime Tolkien Road listener and correspondent Jonathan Rice wrote us with numerous observations on the birds of Middle-earth. Knowing that as an ornithologist, Jonathan brought a unique perspective to this subject, we thought it would be great to spend an entire episode diving into this topic. So with that, Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Yes, welcome.
Glad to be here.
What kind of bird call was that? With the sounded like a
whooping crane.
A whooping crane. There you go.
Perfect. I like it.
Nice. Jonathan Rice is the Urban Bird Conservation Coordinator for the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So Jonathan, before we jump into the Tolkien part of this, I'm just curious about how you got into ornithology in the first place. You know, tell us a little bit about your journey to become a bird nerd, as you call yourself.
Yeah, happy to. So originally I was actually a herp person. So I grew up loving frogs and toads specifically. I have kinds of snakes and turtles, and my older brother and older sisters always helped me catch and keep all kinds of critters of all sorts of kinds. And so I originally had gone off to college thinking that I was going to study herpetology and become a herpetologist.
Mm-hmm.
And my sophomore year, I met a kid who's become one of sort of my three closest friends from school. His name is Lewis. And he was a big birder, a big bird nerd. And he invited a bunch of students from our student chapter of the Wildlife Society to go birding with him. And a couple of us went, and that was sort of the end of it. I remember the first bird that I saw and where I saw it with binoculars. And I was like, I'm a birder now. And from that point on, it was just sort of birding all the time outside of class with friends. And so Lewis and then my friend Matt and Zach, the four of us kind of became our own little fellowship. And Zach is actually one of one of my main friends who I've talked about with Tolkien over the years. He and I used to smoke pipes, and he would read poetry, and we would watch Lord of the Rings in my cabin that I lived in at school. Nice. He was a big role in my love of Tolkien as well. So mix of birds and Tolkien has kind of always been there from the start. So and then I graduated with a bachelor's in fisheries and wildlife sciences. And I spent a year working for the Western Pennsylvania Geese Police. Then I got a job as a summer intern at the Natural History Museum in downtown Pittsburgh. And that rolled into a seasonal tech position and became full time. And I actually celebrated my 5-year anniversary there this past June. So.
Wow. Congratulations. Wow.
Yes. Congrats. Thanks. That is awesome. That's very, very cool.
So that's your journey. I mean, tell us what, like, wax poetic a little bit for us about birds. You know, I mean, for someone to, you know, I can kind of think about it as someone who launched a podcast about this one writer, and just, you know, just endlessly spinning off and just being fascinated about everything by him. You were doing this as a professional, about a certain type of animal, right? A certain type of creature. And so, you know, what is it? Like, wax poetic a little bit for us about birds. Don't get too crazy, because we need to see some of it for the rest of the episode as we talk about Tolkien, but share a little bit about that with us. Yeah.
Birds are just incredible. I mean, the ability for birds to do what they do is just astounding. I mean, a bird that might be 8 or 12 ounces will fly from its breeding grounds in Nova Scotia to the shores of Brazil in a matter of days. I mean, it's just insane. Shorebirds from Alaska will fly nonstop for 5 days to New Zealand. What they're able to do, how they're able to perform these incredible feats year after year after year, and just sort of go on like it's nothing. I mean, that's just sort of large scale. I mean, before they do these massive migratory jumps, all of these hormonal changes happen in their body, and unnecessary organs atrophy, half like their one of their kidneys atrophies, all of their genitals. I know this is a family show. I don't know if I can say that.
No, you're good. Yeah.
All of those atrophy, you know, all of these things. And Greta, I think from a medical point of view, you can kind of grasp the incredibleness of all of these sort of backup things or non-necessary things will atrophy just to reduce weight, and the amount of weight that they'll put on, and they pack fat in their funicular hollow, which is like their clavicle. So when you're handling a bird, so at our banding lab where we catch and band hundreds of thousands of birds, we're actually approaching our 800,000th bird since 1961. But so while you're handling these birds, you can blow on their chest and their feathers blow sort of like out of the way, and you can see this hollow and their skin is translucent. So you can see the level of fat that they've packed on. And sometimes it's really concave. You can say, wow, this bird probably showed up last night or early this morning. Like it's used up all of its fat reserves. Or it's protruding because it's so chubby and packed with fat. And it's like, it's ready to go fly, you know.
Journey to go on. Yeah.
Just, you know, a couple of hours worth of flight at, you know, 2000 feet and fly, leaving Pittsburgh and landing in North Carolina or something. So, maybe going to Kentucky.
there's a bird that can go from Alaska to New Zealand, like without.
There's several. I mean, so many shore, these big shore birds. And we'll get into this a bit. Well, I mean, I can talk about it now, but like, I'm sure you guys are familiar with albatrosses, Rime of the Ancient Mariner, albatross. So albatrosses have what's called a high aspect ratio wing, which means that their wings are really long and thin. So it doesn't take a lot of energy for them to stay aloft. It's like if you watch like swallows like zipping around, they look like little fighter jets. That's a really high aspect ratio wing. So albatrosses have really high aspect ratio wings, and so they can actually stay on the wing for 2 years at a time without landing.
Oh my gosh,
that's insane.
They sleep half their brain at night, which sounds really amazing, but all migratory birds do this, so like when the robins in your yard
that big a deal
are migrating, they're just like, all right, and they'll just, you know, shut down this half of my brain and go to
sleep for a couple. I feel like half my brain is off all the time. So,
And dolphins do this too. Dolphins, you know, when they're in a pod, they do the same thing where they'll shut down half their brain in sleep, and they might swap back and forth like on a microsecond basis, but like over a prolonged period of time, they actually get sleep.
So they sleep while they're flying? Like, mm-hmm. So like half the brain is asleep, but the other half is concentrating on fly.
Yeah. Well, and that's right. That's what I mean. Like they might do that for like microseconds and then swap.
I see. Okay. The
epitome of the micro nap.
Yeah, right.
That's amazing though. But how much more productive would we could do that? I mean,
it's insane. So then you have like just that, and those are mostly just migratory birds. Then you have the incredible feats of the resident birds. So I mentioned that I went to school up in the Adirondacks, and there's birds who, you know, really small songbirds that live up there through the entirety of winter in Canada, in, you know, way up in the Arctic all year round when it's incredibly cold. You might get down to like in the Adirondacks, you might get down to minus 40 degrees during the day. And the ability for, you know, a 10-ounce bird or an 8-ounce bird to not die just from just total, you know, exhaustion. It's so hard to maintain a body temperature. And most of the time they go into something called torpor, which is like not hibernation. What is it when you get really cold, Greta? This happens to people.
Hypothermic?
Yeah.
Hypothermic. So they almost go into a form of like hypothermia called torpor, where they pretty much go to sleep and they sit on a branch and wait for the sun to hit them. And once the sun warms them up enough, they kind of turn back on like Wall-E does. It's just insane. It's just unbelievable what some birds can do, and how they compete with one another and outcompete, or, you know, how they've developed certain ways so they aren't competing with each other. So the diurnal versus nocturnal versus crepuscular, like all these different birds that might be eating the same thing, but they're operating at different times of day. So they're kind of like each other's way. Yeah. It's just insane. I could go on.
I think Jonathan, we just got back from the beach, and whenever we go to the beach, I'm like, I cannot get enough of the pelicans. Like the pelicans are like every
they're
time
little squadrons.
What?
They're little squadrons that they
fly. Yes. They're just like so they're fun. Amazing. And like I probably drive my family nuts, but like literally every time one goes by or I see one, I'm just like I stop in my shack and I'm like, oh, pelican. And I just watch them and I just see Jonathan would get it. Like my kids are like, yeah, whatever, mom.
Oh,
like,
pelicans are cool.
No, I'm not saying that they're not cool, but like it's almost like I can't help myself.
Yeah.
Like if they're near me, I have to stop and just watch them because they just make me so happy.
They're beautiful. Yeah.
This is my wife's life with me all the time with any bird. Like there's been some birds and I've just tried to ignore them, but it's constant.
I love that.
Pelicans are so big and charismatic and it's cool when you get to see them dive into the water.
Yes.
They're very cool. That's
my favorite thing. I was trying to get my kids to watch them the other day, right? When they were diving, they were like, whatever, we already see, you know? And I was like, that's cool. Look at the splash.
I'm getting vibes from Jonathan here on the, like the, you know, the cat, the crazy cat girl level, right? You know the video I'm talking about, you know, the, right. She's just like, she's like trying to talk. It's like a dating video or something like that. She every time she mentions cats, she just starts crying. Like, yeah. I love them so much. That's amazing. Yeah. I love, I just want to know more about birds now. Like, I'm like, I need to go read about birds.
We have one from Evie's class.
Oh, do we? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Sweet.
I don't know what the quality of it is, but,
one. Well, let's pause on birds and talk about your Tolkien fandom, and then we'll come back and we shall bring the two together. So, tell us about how you became a fan of Tolkien.
So I, like you, discovered Tolkien through the Jackson films. Mm-hmm. At the time I was in late elementary school, early middle school. So I don't think that I actually ever watched them until after Return of the King came out. Mm-hmm. I seem to remember my brother having a DVD copy of Return of the King and being like, what is this? So it was clearly beyond that point that I had actually watched them, but that was my first introduction, was watching all the movies. And I thought, you know, they were incredible and what a cool story and, you know, how powerful and, you know, little did I know how unbelievably amazing the actual story is when you read it and being
right.
Oh my gosh, this is an incredible book. Like, it's so good. But I didn't, so I actually had not read the series until college. I had seen the movies through a number of times. And then that friend of mine, Zach, that I had mentioned was a big fan of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And so I finally read it and it was amazing. And then I read The Hobbit. And then I thought about The Silmarillion and he was like, you're not ready. it wasn't for years, you know, and I reread The Lord of the Rings a couple of times. And it wasn't until I was like, I really want to know more about all this mumbo jumbo at the time. You know, there's so much additional stuff in The Lord of the Rings that you're just like, I don't know what any of this means. Just like,
right, yeah.
Get back to Frodo, right? And I wanted to, I knew, you know, that there's more to it and I wanted to understand it. And so I started, at the time I was driving a lot for work and I was toying around with the idea of listening to some podcasts and I was like, maybe I should look for a Tolkien podcast. And I found the Tolkien Road and I listened to it and I was like, perfect. At the time you guys had, I think you had started into the Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
By the winter of 2017 into 2018, you guys were pretty far along at that point. So I would read a chapter and then listen to an episode. And that was, I was also doing that while I was doing work. A lot of times I had tedious type work to do. And so I would just have you guys sort of on there in the background while I was working. And and then I caught up and so then I hit Lord of the Rings and I was like, well, cool. I'll just do this with Lord of the Rings and did that with Lord of the Rings and then did it with The Hobbit and then listened to your books. And I've listened to all the episodes you guys did on Unfinished Tales and then kind of went through and read the whole thing. And then I read The Adventures of Tom Bombadil and I got a bunch of other ones that I haven't touched yet. I keep voting on which book you guys should do next so I can crack open the next one. But really loved the History of Middle Earth series. That was
awesome.
That was intense.
It was intense.
Oh yeah.
It was so good.
I'm glad
you thought so.
There is so much stuff in there that I wish we had I'm just like, okay, this assures me that we will never run out of material for this podcast as long as both of us are living. So
that's for sure. I'm glad we did it, but you're right. It was intense.
From what I could tell by just listening to it, it sounds so much like the formatting of Unfinished Tales. Mm-hmm. I think before anyone gets into trying to read the entirety of the History of Middle Earth, they should probably try Unfinished Tales. It's a little less.
And I hope that with the History of Middle Earth series, that it's the, you know, what we did maybe in doing the survey like that provides people the opportunity to like jump around. Cause I'd be really surprised if you did a scientific survey to find out how many Tolkien fans have actually read like the History of Middle Earth. People who say they've read the History of Middle Earth have actually read it from start to finish, or have just like jumped around and read certain parts of it. Right. Which is fine to me because not everything in there is probably going to be a much interest beyond somebody doing like very intense research on some particular topic. That's so cool to hear that, we played a little bit of a role in helping, helping you kind of dive deeper in Tolkien's world. So,
I'd say you played a huge role.
Awesome.
A very big role. So it's extra special for me to be on the show. It's very surreal. So
thanks so much. It's awesome to have you on the show. So I had two quick questions on Tolkien before we get back into birds. Favorite character. I'm kind of putting you on the spot with these favorite characters / characters.
Oh man, it's so hard not to pick Samwise.
Yeah.
It's hard. I mean, so hard.
It's fine to pick Sam.
It's fine to pick Sam. Yeah, that's totally an acceptable answer.
I don't know. I also have always really liked Faramir. Having the younger brother, where he's coming from. Yeah. It's so hard. Every time you guys have a guest on and I ask, I'm like, I have no idea what I'd say. 90. I'd pick all, they're all great. Every one of them.
Well, we'll make it official as Sam and Faramir. So that's, that works. So
that's what it works.
Hey there, fellow travelers. If you've made it this far on your journey down the Tolkien road, you take Tolkien and Middle Earth as seriously as we do. That being the case, we want to invite you to join the Tolkien Road community over on Patreon. You've certainly heard us give shoutouts to our patrons before, but that's not the only benefit our patrons receive. Other benefits include patron-only episodes, annual gifts, personalized video greetings from John and Greta, early access to new episodes, free copies of my books Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture, and more. Oh yeah, and just in case you find ads like this a bit annoying, Tolkien Road episodes are ad-free on Patreon. That's right. Not only do you get the latest episodes of the Tolkien Road early on Patreon, but you get them commercial-free as well. Most importantly, your monetary support makes it possible for the Tolkien Road to keep on evering on. The truth is, it takes time and money to create this podcast, and every dollar helps us on our quest to make the Tolkien Road something Tolkien himself would be proud of. And by the way, if you're enjoying this interview with Jonathan Rice, be sure to check out our patron-only bonus conversation, where we discuss topics such as Legolas and the Goals, thrushes, dragons, and the winged fell beasts of the Nazgul. So what are you waiting for? Head on over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road for more info. Once again, that's patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Now back to the show. Your email, I received this email from you, and this is not the first email I've received from you, but we've corresponded a lot over the last several years. And but you sent me an email earlier this year that was titled Swans, Crows, and Other Miscellany. And I mean, this thing was, this was not your typical email. This was an essay in ornithology applied to the writings of Middle Earth. What inspired such an in-depth email about the birds of Middle Earth, other than just being a lover of both birds and Middle Earth?
I think part of it comes from the fact that everybody gives so much credit to the eagles.
Yeah.
And not that the eagles don't deserve it, but like, we should spread the love around, I guess, is how I feel. That's also a bias I have from my real world life. I feel like loves the super charismatic like eagles and falcons, and I'm like, there's some really rad birds that aren't eagles, so maybe we should, this thrush that like specifically beats snails against a rock.
Wait a minute, does this bias against eagles have to do with you living in Pittsburgh?
Oh
no,
is this an anti-Philadelphia eagle?
I will back this up by saying that the writings of Rachel Carson, right, Silent Spring, a lot of her writings led to the banning of DDT, which was a chemical that used to be spread on our agricultural fields that caused the shrinking of the lining of eggs of these large birds, which is why their numbers drop off so much, right? They decline, their populations just bottomed out because of this bioaccumulation of this chemical. And by the time they were getting it, there was so much of it, and it was making their eggs really small. So when they lay or sit on their eggs to incubate them, they would just crack and break.
Oh, wow.
Rachel Carson used some of the eggs in our collection, our egg collection at the museum, to help scientifically show that this was happening over time, that the lining of the shells was deteriorating and shrinking. So, no.
That's a fair question, though.
Yeah,
it is.
A fair question.
Ghost Steelers.
I thought that was in there somewhere.
You guys are just baseball fans.
Oh no. We're fans of it all.
If we had to pick one, we'd probably pick baseball.
Well, baseball.
We do.
Yeah.
We do love some NFL.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I'm a Ravens fan, but we will not go there right now.
Yeah.
No, we will just glaze right
over. Pretend that isn't even a thing.
Well, yeah. She went to school in Philadelphia, so you know. So she's got a little bit of Philadelphia connection there too. All right. So, So anyway, I interrupted you on the Eagles thing though. So a little sidebar. So continue down the path that you were with this email and what inspired it.
Just that, you know, I feel like so often gulls and eagles are talked about, and yet there's so many incredible birds in the stories of Tolkien and his writings that play a pretty critical role. I already mentioned the thrush, the ravens from The Hobbit. I remembered the episode where you guys got to that. And it's just like, I think the episode's titled like A Cloud of Birds or something like that. And in the opening, you guys are like, I bet John really liked this chapter. I did. It's lots of birds. Just birds talking to other birds. It's great. So there's so much to it. I mean, obviously the eagles play a huge role. But I also feel like people use the eagles as a cop-out to the story. I mean, you guys know that, where people always say, oh, the hobbits just should have
ridden the eagles.
Mordor, yeah. And it's like they had a culture of their own. They were respected. Right. They weren't just a taxi service. So, and at the time I had been reading through Unfinished Tales, and I kept seeing swans, specifically in Turin, his Coming to Gondolin. These swans just seemed like specifically important. And I remember Galadriel's big swan boat. And I don't know, that made me think more about, is there something there? And then I thought, well, I've never really thought about like pulling together everywhere that birds are connected in sort of the legendarium that I'm able to grasp. And so I just kind of started doing that and thinking about it. And then we had corresponded a little bit about birds. And I think it was, is it Marilyn?
Yep. Marilyn, the librarian. Yep.
She had reached out, her and I had sort of corresponded through you about some stuff. And I was like, I should just put all of this down in a really big email, that, you know, I was like, oh, just like put a little bit of this. And then it just kept growing and more came out and it just kept adding to it. So, it wasn't meant to be as beefcaked up as it was, yeah. But it turned out to be an awful large. So,
no, it was great. And you know, here we are now. Right. So, you done good. Mm-hmm. Well, so let's start. I wanted to dive into some of the detail of it. So you mentioned, did you mention swans yet?
Or did I just already have that? Did.
Yes. He just, yeah. Yes. We mentioned a lot of birds already, but, yeah. Let's talk about swans. Cause that's a lot of your email. So you mentioned of Tuor from the coming of or from Unfinished Tales, Tuor and the coming to Gondolin. I think of that title right. So that's where we get swans discussed. But then you kind of jump over, and there's this mention of black swans in The Lord of the Rings. So tell, like, introduce that for us.
So right after the Fellowship leaves Lorien, right after we see Galadriel's white swan boat, the very next chapter, I think, is titled The River. They're sort of going through this marshy area, and they mention, you know, that they can hear all of these marsh birds piping and tweeting and whatnot. And then they see these really large birds take off, and Sam says something like, you know, they're swans, and they're mighty big ones too. And Aragorn says, you know, yeah, they're black swans. And then that was it. It just moves on.
Yeah.
And it's so, I do not believe that anywhere Tolkien just has sort of a throwaway, like, oh, let's make a black swan and move on. Like, that doesn't, we know that doesn't happen.
He didn't really do that. He wasn't that kind of writer. Yeah.
To call it out like that, because most people, when you say, oh yeah, they're mighty big swans, you just picture big white swans, because most swans are white, and these were not, for some reason. And so I looked up, and there's a couple species. There's a species from Australia that's been introduced to the UK, that are a prominently black swan. But then I found this weird thing called the black swan theory. Which this guy, I've got all sorts of notes here in my shout out to my Tea with Tolkien.
Oh, notes. Cool.
Yeah, this thing is amazing. Yeah. Nice. Yes, big shout out to Caitlin, Tea with Tolkien. Wonderful journal. Everyone should get one. So I've got a bunch of notes in here. But in short, there's sort of three things that make up the black swan theory. One is that it carries, or no, I'm sorry, it's an outlier. It happens outside of sort of the realm of regular expectation. So it's a surprise. Nobody can, you wouldn't expect it. One of the big examples of this is 9/11. Mm-hmm. So no, that's such a surprise. Nobody could have ever in the realm of possibility expected that to happen, right? So it's a surprise. Two, it carries an extreme impact. There you go. Easy enough. And three, in spite of its outlier status, human nature makes us concoct explanations for its occurrence after the fact, making it explainable and predictable. So that is all stuff that I pulled directly from the internet.
Yeah, it's on I something very similar on the Wikipedia page about black swan theory when I was I've heard this idea before. I feel like this is a kind of an idea that's been floating around in the culture, in kind of pop culture circles for a little while. Not like big, not like mainstream pop culture, but kind of like, you know, I don't know, just this interesting concept of like when people refer to a black swan event or something like that, you know?
Yeah. And so I read far too much than I needed to about what is black swan theory. And I was trying to think about like, okay, so how would this, and in reality, black swan theory was not a theory until recently, like I think. So it was not something that Tolkien was aware of in his time. And the term a black swan is actually has, I think ancient, I can't remember if it's ancient Greek or Roman roots now, where at the time they did not believe that black swans exist. So they used that as, like if they said that something was a black swan, it meant like it didn't exist, right? And so I don't know. There was some changing throughout time. This is where I read too much into it, I think. But sort of what I came down to it was wondering how does this possibly coincide with the ongoings of where we are in the story with the Fellowship kind of heading down the Anduin. And one thought I had was, it is sort of a black swan as opposed to a white swan. Is it supposed to be some sort of dark foreshadowing of the events that are about to happen, which we all know, the breaking of the Fellowship, you know, the death of Boromir, Merry and Pippin being taken to Isengard. Is it something like that, which kind of fits a little more in line with Tolkien's use of sort of light and dark imagery and shadowing more so than any of these other things that I've read about black swan theory.
Right.
So you don't
I'd love
think
to hear other people's thoughts on that.
Were they actually, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. So with these, like these would have been literal black swans though, right? In the, in the book.
Right.
So you're just talking about how, like, what purpose did they serve?
Yeah.
Like, how did they kind of aid the telling of the story?
Yeah. So as we as the reader are experiencing the Fellowship encountering these black swans, like what are we supposed to read into that? Because if you just sort of take it as a throwaway, it's so strange that just for whatever reason, I mean, there's no real reason for Sam to call out that there's big swans and for Aragorn to respond that they're black.
Black.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally move on with the story as if it's just this like tiny little interject that means nothing. It kind of doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry, I'm losing light, so I'm gonna flick on a light really quick.
But I was gonna suggest that if you need to flip something on, then do that. Yeah, it's getting dark.
Yeah, being an hour ahead of, well, yeah, sun's going down here too, I guess.
I feel like I hear a lot of critters in the background, so I'm assuming you have like animals that live there that are in that room.
No.
Oh, you know, I thought I heard some in the background. That's right.
I have windows open.
Oh, you have windows open. You're always,
I can close them if they're a problem with the audio.
No. I love it.
If it adds to.
I love the ambiance.
Absolutely. So I do have another question. Mm-hmm. Do the black swans come up again anywhere? No, that's like the only mention of them.
I have it bookmarked.
That's the one and only place.
Okay. If you guys don't mind, I'll just toss it out.
Yeah.
Literally, they describe, you know, once or twice the travelers heard the rush and whine of swan wings, and looking up, they saw a great phalanx streaming along the sky. Swans, said Sam, and mighty big ones too. Yes, said Aragorn, and they are black swans. And then we move on. That's literally all we get. Just
Wow.
That definitely sounds like it's intended to be a, you know, foreboding, right?
Like, I mean, foreshadowing.
So they'd been in, you know, they'd been in,
Lothlorien.
Yeah, thank you, Lothlorien. obviously having kind of a little stay there after the tragedy of losing Gandalf. So, you know, you think they're on the mend, and here they are on the, you know, on what ends up being kind of the last leg of the journey of the Fellowship as the Fellowship, right? And they're getting ready to head into this perilous situation. They don't necessarily know it's going to be a perilous situation at this point. I was wondering, and I don't have the context in front of me, one thought that occurred to me was, could this be a thing where, like, this is like a sign of Gollum being on their trail, and like that he like disturbed the birds or something like that? You know, perhaps that has something to do with it. But I think, I mean,
that's a good idea.
Well, I don't have the context of it to kind of examine it too much, but I think it's just enough to say that they're black, like Aragorn saying they're black swans. Well, that's probably not a good sign, right? You know,
This is right in here is where Sam and Frodo spot Gollum following them in the river. So he's 100% right on their tail at this time. So right. And I mean, it's in the day. He could be lurking. We know from him, his travels through dead marshes or death marshes? They get into Mordor, or right before they get into Mordor, that he certainly knows his way through a marsh. So that could 100% be it.
Yeah.
Having been in wetlands myself, I can tell you that waterfowl are very skittish.
Yeah.
They will take off. Even though Gollum is pretty sneaky, that, you know, it's the middle of the day. That could totally be it. Less of what's about to come, but what's surrounding them, what's following them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think too, it's another thing that occurred to me is it's not going to, you know, they're heading in this direction where the next they're going to start seeing more black beasts of the air, right? And much scarier, right? So they go from seeing black swans, and then eventually, obviously, Frodo and Sam are going to be harassed by the Nazgul on their fell beasts, right? Which are giant. We don't even really know what they are. They're like some kind of.
They're more of a reptilian, I think.
Yeah, reptilian, exactly. I'm just in general, this black swan theory thing is really, really fascinating to me. So the thing I connected it to from reading your email as well is the description of the black swan theory is, it's very similar to Tolkien's idea of the Yew catastrophe. Now the Yew catastrophe has a positive idea to it, but it's basically a positive version of a catastrophe, right? Which is a bad thing. You know? And what's interesting to me is the black swan theory doesn't, in what I've read about it so far, it doesn't seem to indicate that it has to be a bad thing. It could just be an it's a highly unexpected event. Sorry, it gets me back to eagles again, because it's like eagles show up whenever one of these two catastrophes happen, right? So black swan theory ties back to the eagles
eventually. Just juxtaposition, right? The black swan is a foreboding symbol, and the eagles are a happy, or, you know.
And I'm sure the black swans are perfectly nice, so I feel kind of bad for them.
I'm sure they are.
Our daughter loves cats, and she, like, you just, like, mention that black cats are bad luck, and she will, like, go on a rant for, like, 10 minutes about how that's so unfair, and just because a cat is black doesn't mean it's evil and bad luck and all the things, and poor black cats, how did they ever get that, you know, the reputation? So anyway.
Yeah. So this black, it got me, I've been fascinated recently reading about, Chernobyl, the horrible nuclear meltdown that took place in 1986 in the Ukraine. And that got me thinking, I was like, I think that qualifies as a black swan event. Cause like they, you know, they look back on it now and they try to explain it, but even still, they're like, really, even though they did all this stuff wrong, it shouldn't have happened. It was a huge catastrophe, right?
And that's like what I find so interesting about it is like the pin in it is that afterwards we as humans tried to explain it away.
Got to rationalize it. Yeah,
we find a way to rationalize it because we don't like irrational major events changing our lives. You know, we want to be able to say, even in hindsight, that somebody should have seen this coming and someone should have acted, or, you know, in a bad situation, or, you know, whatever the case may be. If it's a good situation, because like you said, it's both a it could be a you catastrophe or just a regular old catastrophe. It's just that that's the part of it that makes it so interesting, is that there's this human bias component as far as explaining, trying to explain it away.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Hey there, fellow Tolkienites. Since you happen to be listening to this podcast, I thought you'd be excited to hear that my books Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture are now available on Audible. Tolkien's Requiem is an exploration of the First Age story of Beren and Lúthien, as found in The Silmarillion. In Tolkien's Requiem, I explore how the story is rooted in Tolkien's own life and the important role it plays in the Middle-earth legendarium. One reader called it a gift to the world, and another said, I wish I'd been able to read Tolkien's Requiem years ago. Tolkien's Overture explores Ainur Lendile, the music of the Ainur, which is the Middle-earth creation story. In Tolkien's Overture, I conduct a close reading of the text as found in the Silmarillion and proceed to unpack the incredible role that music plays in the legends and lives of Middle-earth. One reader called it an excellent book, a critical and thoughtful deep dive into Ainur Lendile. Both books have been recently re-recorded in order to meet professional audiobook standards. Not only are both books available in audiobook format via Audible, but in signed paperback and Kindle as well. To learn more about Tolkien's Requiem, visit tolkiensrequiem.com. To learn more about Tolkien's Overture, visit tolkiensoverture.com. Or just go to tolkienroad.com/books to see them both at once. Seriously, though, I'm really proud of both of these books, and I know that you, like so many others, will enjoy them. So do yourself a favor and check them out. TolkienRoad.com/books. And now, back to the show.
Yeah, I think Tolkien definitely intended the black swans in that case to be a foreboding, symbol. The history of this theory, you know, I'd have to read more about it, like, to know if that's something he would have been familiar with. But I would not be surprised to learn that Tolkien, like, it was some kind of symbol, like, that he would have been familiar with, especially as I'm realizing because of you, like, how much, like, whoa, he had a lot about birds all over.
Yeah. Well, guy liked his nature, you know, he loved trees. He was such an epic naturalist in so many ways. And as sort of an aspiring naturalist, it's so enjoyable to read where that comes out in his books and in his stories. It's pretty incredible.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, and you can't really separate birds and trees a lot of the time. No. Right. I mean, you gotta go hand in hand.
Well, what I was going to say is that, this got me thinking about, Aule and Yavanna, the chapter from, the Silmarillion, where of course Aule creates the dwarves, gets into trouble with Iluvatar, and then Iluvatar is gracious and gives them, you know, gives them life. And then Aule, and it becomes a point of contention between Aule and Yavanna, because she's like, great, now they're going to chop down all my trees. And bam, this is all in a nutshell, but like, and then she collaborates with Manwë, and they're like, okay, we'll bring eagles into this equation, right?
Yeah.
The eagles like the dwarves and other things that cut down trees, and the eagles are going to live in the trees, right? You got the tree and bird thing going on, on right there. So are you going to say?
Yeah, you reminded me of something when you were back when we were talking about the foreboding aspect of it. It reminded me that at the very beginning of that chapter, the chapter is called The Great River, Aragorn is sort of having this internal conversation with himself, and he mentions that, for he had felt in his heart that time was pressing, and he feared that the Dark Lord had not been idle while they lingered in Lorien. So very much to your point about they had been, you know, tarrying in Lorien, and then now that they're leaving, they're kind of remembering, crap, this is where we're at, this is what we're doing. And like sort of within, at the end of the fourth paragraph, two paragraphs past that little passage I just read, is where the black swans come in. And so, I think also there's some weight to that, given that Aragorn is the one that responds and says that they're black swans, having just been thinking that. So I think that, yeah, to your point, there's probably a lot of foreboding there as far as like reminding the reader where the story is now going back, where we're headed again, because Lorien is such a wonderful little place to pause. And
yeah, absolutely.
It's a good kind of way to jumpstart your system to remember where you're heading.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
Good point. Yeah.
So you continue in this email talking about swans, and we go into discussion of Ulmo and the Teleri from there. So going to narrate that, you know, what you were talking about there for us.
Yeah. So again, this is kind of one of the kernels of all of this was reading in Unfinished Tales. There's a section of Tuor and his coming to Gondolin where it's his traveling, you know, to get to Gondolin in the first place. And to kind of jump through it, he's on his way and he's trying to find where he needs to go. And he doesn't know, you know, it's Gondolin. Nobody knows how to get there. And he's trying to find his way. And he's in this river valley and he's traveling along this river valley and he hears these great bird cries and he looks up to see three large white birds. Mm-hmm. And he's fascinated by them. So he scales the cliff to keep watching them. And in that moment, this huge, huge flood comes down the river valley. And he's like, these birds just saved my life. Like, they called me up on the cliff right before this huge flood came through. And so then he was like, cool, all right, well, I'm just going to follow these birds, I guess. And so he starts following these birds. And he eventually comes to this place and he's waiting there for a while. It's like a nice spot where he's got lots of food and, you know, and whatever. He's just hanging out. And I think he's by a lake, and seven swans come in and he's like, oh, cool, like the swans are back. And they come in and land, and almost immediately after landing, they like take off and they like whip over top of him and they're like squawking and they're real angry. And then they do like three big circles and they start flying south. And he realizes, you know, I've been tarrying here too long. I need to keep moving. Like, I can't forget, you know, my quest. I need to keep moving. And so he then follows these swans and he literally like, he just like travels with them as they're flying. And for a human to walk at the same speed that a bird is flying is like impossible. Birds fly pretty fast, especially a big bird like that. They're moving, you know, maybe on average 30 or 40 kilometers an hour, wow. Whatever that is in miles per hour. So they're moving pretty fast that just a human could not keep up with them. So that was a one tick for me, that like these birds are flying slow enough for him to keep up with them. And they lead him to the ruined city of Vinyamar. And he knows this city. I think it was one of the original cities of the Noldor.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, a ruin, nobody lives there anymore, but they land on sort of this Western open door kind of, and he says he feels like they're trying to invite him inside. And so he goes inside and he finds this throne and like this old armor, like set of armor and stuff. And then one of them like quote unquote calls him down to the, like to the ocean side, cause there's sort of like an inlet that comes in to meet Vinyamar from the sea. And so he goes down there and that's where Ulmo like comes out of the ocean and it's like, hey, here's what's up. This is what you're going to do.
Yeah.
It's this insanely epic part of the story. And this whole time I'm like, the swans led him there. He would have never, you know, who knows how long it would have taken him to get there. And they led him, you know, both to the building and then down to the water's edge to meet him. And that's where Ulmo gives him a message to give to Turgon and tells him how to get to Gondolin. And then he gives him the like ancient armor set that's in the building. And it's like, you know, all brand new again. And it's this like special elvish, you know, armor and sword and things that I think he said that Turgon would recognize, that he was like coming as an emissary of Ulmo, something like that. Mm-hmm. I apologize for not remembering all of this. I wrote this. So I haven't been back to revisit it.
No, you're connecting it all really well. Yeah.
Right.
So that's sort of where the swans end. But for me, that's also where Ulmo ends, where Ulmo's direct encounter ends, is at that point. So the fact that between Tuor getting from where he needed to be to where he was going to meet Ulmo, he was three different times kind of pushed there by these great swans.
Yeah.
And so that was one of these, one of the first times I really thought, like, I think swans might have a greater like hold in the legendarium, like eagles are the emissaries of Manwë, that swans might be something similar to Ulmo.
Right. Yeah.
Immediately made me think of Galadriel, because of her big swan boat, and having known that she's one of the Noldor, I was like, well, maybe there's something there. And so then a little bit later in Unfinished Tales, there's a whole section on the history of Galadriel and Celeborn. Mm-hmm. And those two are just, in a lot of ways, a mess. I mean, there's so much that Tolkien wrote and rewrote and then rewrote some more and then erased it and wrote it again. And there's like, I think it's pretty much set how Galadriel is, you know, set down, but there's so much other ways that he had thought about it. And I feel like Celeborn is even more mysterious in that in some scenarios, he never actually made the crossing to Valinor in the first place. Like, he was one of the elves that stayed. Mm-hmm. And in the version, he did cross, and he was one of the Teleri, and him and Galadriel sort of got together in Valinor. And Galadriel's mother is, I have it written down so I wouldn't forget, Eowyn, the daughter of Olwë, who was like the chief of the Teleri.
Teleri, yeah. I was going to say she's half Noldor, half Teleri. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's, I found in a number of different passages where there's a connection between the two, mm-hmm. You know, between Galadriel and Celeborn and the Teleri. Also, Galadriel having been a daughter of Finarfin. Mm-hmm. And Finarfin's kin did not take part in the kinslaying at Aqualandë because of the connection to the Teleri. Mm-hmm. And so that was another thing that connected me to the Teleri. And the reason that I found that particular part interesting is because, obviously the Teleri look to Ulmo. That's why they live on the shores. He's sort of their chief Valar in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And then surprisingly, I picked up on some of the philological stuff, which was like, woo. they had a breakdown.
The ultimate level of connecting with Tolkien. Yeah, connecting with the mind of Tolkien.
And it was a breakdown in a totally different section of Unfinished Tales where they're talking about the history of Londir and Tharbad, which was the port city that actually Tar Eldarion from Eldarion and Arrendis, the mariner's wife, had created. You know, it was his major port city that he, his first one that he built in Middle Earth, right? And so there's this whole section in there about the wetlands that make up this area. And so in that, there was a whole section that Christopher broke down the etymological, philological parts of words. And I saw this little section that broke down both in Sindarin, right? Not Sindarin, Sindarin.
Sindarin, yeah.
Sindarin and Quenya, where the words mean different versions of swan. Like, this is like Swan Haven, this is Swan Fleet. And they had like all this stuff about how the words were used in swan. And one of them for Quenya, the like prefix alqua is swan. And I was like, okay, well, that's like Aqualandë, right? And so I flipped to the X, and Aqualandë means haven of swans. So the chief city of the Teleri is called the Haven of Swans. So
yeah.
This is where, like, I don't feel like Tolkien did things for nothing, and I feel like I'm making connections that mean something.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are.
I really love the idea that just as Manwë had his, you know, the eagles, we kind of think of as his like heralds or messengers, right? Mm-hmm. That Ulmo had his birds, right? That were waterfowl, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly.
So they were different because, of course, he is the lord of the sea, and I was thinking to myself that Ale has Allie doesn't get birds because he made Yovana mad.
No, he gets rocks.
He gets rocks. That's right.
Some rocks. Some nice rocks.
And then Thresh has just used the rocks to break snakes. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like rock, paper, scissors, and the Thresh wins.
That's right. Exactly. That's right.
Swans are always viewed as being like this regal. There's always like very regal imagery around swans, and so I feel like it makes sense that eagles are sort of on this level and swans are kind of also on that level.
That makes sense.
Of all of the culture that we know the eagles have and the Lord of the Eagles and their communication with Gandalf, like, did the swans have this? Did they have some patch of marsh somewhere where they had, you know, they had this culture, and did they communicate with Radagast or something? You know, that would be, I don't remember which Valar sent Radagast. Oh, it was Yovana, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Sent Radagast.
I believe that's right. Yeah. Because he
can only imagine she would have.
He's fascinated with all like the critters, you know, and yeah, those were hers. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I guess the fact that I understand what you're saying about swans being kind of that regal, have kind of regal kingly air about them. Because I was kind of wondering why maybe not pelicans, you know, why couldn't they have been almost messengers? But I mean, swans.
I can't remember an instance of pelicans in the Legendarium. They're gulls.
No.
I mean, there's lots of gulls.
Lots of gulls.
Yeah. Lots of gulls, but no pelicans. I'm sure they exist, but they're just stated. But. Yeah, I can't imagine a pelican. Have you ever seen a pelican yawn?
I'm sure it's a little frightening.
I think everyone listening right now should pause and go look up a video or picture of a swan a pelican yawning, because they're that, like, that patch under their bottom mandible is like so flabby that when they yawn, their like head comes back and their neck like kind of pops up out of their lower mandible as they yawn. It's very horrific. It doesn't look right. So I just picture that and go, I don't think any Valar would want to be like, that's my guy.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. Yeah.
And like not a lot of things mess with a swan.
Here we go.
But I mean, oh.
We're looking at it on YouTube here right now. The pelican yawn.
Whoa.
they bend back into their own neck. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I'll have to link to that.
Yes.
I'll link to that for the show notes so everybody can see.
It doesn't look right. It doesn't look right.
Yeah, I think that's why the cool thing about swans, though, is like you said, nothing really messes with them. But I would honestly rather not mess with the pelican because they have like that really long pointy beak. But I've heard that swans are really mean.
Oh, yeah. One attacked my sister when we were little. Yeah, you don't mess with a swan. They're huge, and they don't mess around. They know they're big, and they know they're strong.
Yeah.
They're intense. Well, and to kind of jump to our natural world and talking about pelicans, peregrine falcons love to take down pelicans, and the way that they do it is while the pelicans are flying, the peregrine falcon will come up behind it and just like pull up on its bill just enough while it's flying, and their whole head snaps back and they start falling because they're so, you know, it is a weird shape. That's not meant to be.
Very strange.
Something like, is shaped like that.
It's like they're bullying the pelican because it's funny looking.
Well, you know, they want to eat their young what it is. So, but yeah, they're, you know, pelicans, there's just a lot of things that if I were a Valar and I watched sort of the like America's Funniest Home Videos of pelicans, I'd be like, I don't think this is guy. Let's move on to the next candidate. Pelicans are cool, don't get me wrong, but you know.
I understand. I totally get it. You've made
they're a little goofy.
They are goofy. I don't know why I love them so much, but yeah, I think swans are probably more appropriate for this purpose.
They do look really majestic when they're like flying in squadron, you know, just like across, you know, across an ocean front. So for sure. So all right, I need to ask you. You mentioned that kingfisher is your favorite bird.
They're on my shirt right now.
What?
On my shirt.
Oh, on your shirt. Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
My best bird shirt.
Oh, we're honored. That's fantastic.
So why a kingfisher?
So kingfishers are my favorite because they're like the epitome of bad A in a tiny package.
Yeah.
So birds that outcompete herons and egrets and eagles, right? All these other big fish or birds that eat fish. And a kingfisher is about an on average, like our kingfisher that we have in North America, the belted kingfisher is like 12 to 13 inches. That's all the bigger it is. It's just this tiny little squat, little.
Yeah, they're not.
Razor billed, you know, they're ready to mess you up kind of bird. And they're really rad because they burrow into creek sides or like riverbanks, and that's where they nest. They don't build like a traditional nest. And they catch fish by flying around a lake or a pond or a creek, and they'll spot a fish. And so then they hover. So they flap in midair and like keep them in one, they keep themselves in a fixed location while they're watching a fish. And then they duck their wings and dive. And sometimes they can dive so fast that the air around them, and if the fish is close enough to the surface, that they catch the fish and the air pocket around them pushes the water aside and they catch the fish before they even get wet.
That's amazing. What? Oh my gosh.
And then they, once they've caught the fish, they, you know, they're underwater and they fly up to like a snag or like a dead tree, you know, in a lake, and they'll land on a branch and then they beat the fish against the trunk of the tree until it's dead and then they swallow it.
And swallow it whole?
Epic thing to watch. Just you, this incredible, they have this rattle. They don't sing. They just do this rattle. And it's, you're just like walking along a creek or something and you hear this rattle and you stop and then it like zings by. And oh, they're just so cool. And they come in, they're all over the world. There's 86 species. They come in like insane bright magentas and fluorescent blue.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And like, they're incredibly beautiful. There's like dwarf pygmy kingfishers that are like, you know, 3 inches tall, but they're bright and beautiful. And then there's like the, you know, the like kookaburras, they're a kingfisher.
Oh, I didn't know. So
they're just this really rad bird.
They're like, I'm beautiful, don't mess with me.
Yeah.
How many?
And they have a blue mohawk. So
yeah.
That yes. How many species of them are there in North America?
Just the one.
The one. Kingfisher.
Yeah, we only have one. We're really shortchanged.
Oh man.
It's in Latin and South America that are always like, oh, here's this. And I'm like, could you just send it up here, please?
And just a cool name too. They get the cool name, right? Kingfisher.
They do. I mean, that's a kingfisher. It's pretty awesome. Rad.
Are you familiar, this is a complete sidebar, but are you familiar with the Gerard Manley Hopkins poem As Kingfishers Catch Fire?
Mm-mm. No.
Yeah, it's a sonnet written by the 19th century poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, and it's called As Kingfishers Catch Fire. So I'm sure you'd enjoy it.
I'm sure I will.
It's tribute to the kingfisher for sure. Yeah. So all right, well, so the next part of your email really focuses on crows and the cribbit, which I think I'm saying this right, but cribbit, but talk to us a little bit about your observations there.
So those, I actually had not really picked out in sort of my thinking through all of the birds, you know, in the legendarium. That was one that Marilyn, the librarian, had brought up in correspondence that was like, hey, ask John about these weird crows. Like, what's going on with this? Mm-hmm. Like, what is she talking about? I didn't even remember them, which tells
you. So these are the crows that are when the fellowship is traveling south from Rivendell, right? When the ring goes south. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And they're hiking, and I can't remember if it's Gandalf or Aragorn, somebody yells crows, and they all kind of dive under rocks as the crows kind of, this like murmuration of crows blows through and then leaves. And I think Gandalf says that they're spies of Sauron, at some point. But right. So those are the crows that she was mentioning. And so I looked it up on, like, I don't think it was the One Ring. I think it was like the One Wiki.
Yes. Yeah. Lord of the Rings wiki.com or wikia.com. Yeah.
Yeah. And so basically they're just a crow that lives in the forests of, Dunling,
mm-hmm.
Dunland, that area, which is on the, I think that it abuts Isengard, which makes sense that mm-hmm. Sauron have access to them there. They kind of just, I took a little bit of issue with, they were like, oh yeah, they're just kind of silly, stupid crows that do whatever Sauron wants. And I'm like, crows are one of the, corvids are the smartest of all the birds. They're brilliant. Crows and ravens specifically are just absolutely brilliant. I mean, the crow or the ravens in The Hobbit, you know, can communicate with the dwarves. So I took a little bit of issue with that. I was like, don't be talking down to the crows. Crows are incredible, man. They're brilliant.
Kind of like rats, I guess, right? They get a bad rap, but they're pretty intelligent when it comes to that type of creature. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, their problem solving is incredible. Like, and not only the problem solving, because a lot of corvids are just really, really good problem solvers. You'll give them like a 13 step puzzle to solve and let you like take one part out so that they could actually jump from steps 1 to 5. They'll immediately recognize it and jump from step 1 to 5 and finish. Like, they can recognize like that level of problem solving, that it's not just repetition, but that it's, you know, they can individualize, you know, the different parts of it. But so not only that, but like, they can recognize human faces. So John, go out there every day and, you know, shake your fist and throw rocks at the crows. They'll teach their young, don't trust that guy. He's a jerk. But if Greta goes out there and like leaves them nuts and pieces of meat, the crows will teach their young to trust her because she's kind. Crazy that they not only recognize faces, but they remember faces, and then they can transfer that information to their young to better prepare their young. Like, that whole level of like education in Black stuff is so fascinating. You know, the idea of parental care and teaching a young, you know, your young to survive as best it can. You know, it makes sense that nature pushes parents in that direction to be much, much better. But that was pretty groundbreaking when people discovered that they could actually identify faces and then teach their young. That's pretty incredible. So
absolutely.
Wow. I never thought that much of crows, but I've
I mean, they're loud and make a mess, and you know, they don't have the most beautiful song, but like, credit where credit's due.
Oh, for sure.
Aren't always the best looking.
No, I mean, we all have
our strengths.
All our strengths and weaknesses. Yeah, absolutely. That's fascinating. That is really.
Yeah, cool. I had no idea that crows were, were one of the more highly intelligent birds at all. You know, I think you talk some about their, their ability just to the survival, like admiration for their survival skills, right? You know, their ability to adapt. That's one of the things you talk about here is that. Tell this. Okay. So I found this fascinating. Tell this story about crows and crosswalks.
So crows have learned in cities to utilize crosswalks to access food that they otherwise couldn't get. So, you know, there's a limitation just based on the size of your beak, how big a nut you can break open to get what's inside. Right. And so the crows understand this. And so instead of just being like, all right, well, I won't eat that, I'll eat other stuff. They say, well, what if I get something else to break that open? They observe and learn how crosswalks work and how traffic flow works. And so they land on like traffic lights and they'll drop a nut in the street and you know, wait for the traffic to drive through and drive over the nut and break it open. And then when the human crosswalk sign changes, they know that it's safer to be around humans than it is to be in amongst the cars. So they wait for the humans to start crossing the street, and then they fly down and pick up what was broken out of their whatever the nut it was they were trying to break open.
Oh my gosh, that's
incredible. I mean, there's like footage of us watching them do this, and it's like real world problem solving. It's incredible. So
wow, that is awesome.
That is fantastic. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I love that.
I mean, how do birds think of humans? Like, what, like can, do you have a way of like kind of explaining that, like when they like what, how they regard us?
I think it depends based on species. I mean, there's the birds are such a wide group. I mean, swan is gonna look at you differently than a little sparrow might, because a swan is ready to go toe to toe, and a sparrow is just absolutely sure it's gonna die. It just knows it. It doesn't have a chance. Its only chance is escape. Mm-hmm. And a swan, you know, they'll get up and they'll get their wings out and they'll start hissing at you and they're ready to throw down. So I think it really depends. some hawks and falcons will slice your scalp open. If you get close to their nest, they are not afraid and they will mess you up. Any kind of bird of prey, just keep your distance, because you should be a lot more scared of them than they are of you.
Yeah. Aerial advantage for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, their talons are incredibly sharp and insanely fast and borderline silent. I mean, owls will mess you up too. But you get any kind of small songbird, most of them are at first going to be afraid of you, thinking you're a big predator. But, you know, I've spent time just sitting outside in a chair near my bird feeders, and the birds that are nesting here in my yard that have come back year after year to nest, they know that I sit out there by the bird feeder. They will come and use the bird bath and just kind of chill. And, you know, I was sitting on my back patio, and we had a bird feeder at the time, and there were some Carolina wrens nesting in it. And I was sitting, you know, not further than I am from my laptop right now. And the fledglings just kind of popped out of the birdhouse for the first time and took off. I mean, they were terrified of me, but they were chill enough to, like, the parents would come and go, they'd fly in right next to me, you know, and hop in with big grubs and caterpillars and stuff. And then once the young fledged, they all left. But a lot of them will habituate. There's a species called the Canada Jay. They're like a blue jay, but they're cuter. They're all gray. They're gray and white, and they're really poofy. And there's places where you can go and you can put bird seed in your hand, and you just stand in this one particular part of the forest, and they'll just fly down and land in your hand and eat seed right out of your hand, and then they'll leave. And part of that is because people have been doing it for so long that they associate food with humans, which isn't a good thing necessarily, but it's not like we're attracting bears.
Right.
Worse.
Yeah.
And there's some other birds that will do that. Black-capped chickadees, most of the chickadees will do stuff like that. Other little songbirds. I think it's a lot of how much time you're willing to put into habituating yourself with them. And if you're willing to go out there and sit and just watch and wait and be quiet, and they will kind of learn to be cool around you. Just don't wave like a tennis racket or something and you're fine. A lot of people use lots of hummingbird feeders, and like, especially places in the Southwest where there's just like dozens of species of hummingbirds. Up here, we only have the one. And they'll have, you know, a couple hundred hummingbirds fly in, and they're just like landing all over these people and drinking out of their feeders. Part of that is because they're so unbelievably exhausted, you know, that they're going to die. So they're just kind of like, this guy's cool. I've been coming here for years. He's not going to hurt me. I'll just land on him. That's another really interesting one, you know, hummingbirds and hummingbird feeders and how people have habituated hummingbirds with bees. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
It feels like I got to get around to setting up all of our bird feeder stuff in our backyard, which I've been meaning to do for a while. So,
yeah.
for many years now. Well, all right. So before we jump over to our patron only, content, I want a final verdict. Jonathan, I want to know from you, how does Tolkien do representing for birds overall from an ornithologist?
Double thumbs up.
Double thumbs up.
He gets two thumbs up.
Nice.
Fantastic. I would have expected nothing less for someone who truly had such attention to detail and appreciated the natural world as much as he did, and appreciated the natural world on just the natural level, but also kind of on a spiritual level as well. You know, it's always fascinating to me, how he just knew so much to put into his work, all the trappings that make it seem real.
Yeah. When you can totally feel that in the like 20 years that he spent writing it, specifically talking about the Lord of the Rings, that every detail was researched to a serious degree. I did some research on the thrush from The Hobbit, and there is one species of bird from Europe. There's one species in the world, and it's a thrush that eats snails like this. There's only the one. So even that he pulled directly from the real world, you know. And I looked up what Peter Jackson put in the movie and in my illustrated version of The Hobbit. And I'm like, it's kind of a nondescript thrush, but like, it's also pretty spot on. But like that level for me, as you know, like I've said, as somebody who enjoys the natural world and is reading through and seeing anatomically accurate depictions of birds, the proper names for birds, the proper names for the parts of birds and how they're behaving and how they're acting is so, I mean, he paints it perfectly. Like I would expect to see, you know, rowing down the Anduin. I mean, it's exactly how it should be in the real world. And in a fantasy world, to have that level of like anchorage that you can anchor yourself in there because you can hear it, you can feel it, you can see it. You've been in a situation just like that. And that level of verisimilitude and realism that anchors yourself in this fantasy world, it's what makes Tolkien the best above all the rest.
Amen to that. Mm-hmm. Good stuff.
Yeah.
So with that, we're going to wrap up this episode and we're going to take it over to our patron only content. So you are not going to want to miss this. We're going to be discussing seagulls, a little bit more about eagles. And we're going to also talk to Jonathan and just try to get some thoughts from him on dragons. So, and see nice. What we have to say about that. I think that you know, he might have a lot to say because we're talking about a guy who got into ornithology after being into herpetology. So it's kind of the cross between the two. Perfect. Maybe.
I got thoughts and feelings.
Yeah. Thoughts and feelings, many. So you don't want to miss out on that. So join us over there, everybody. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
A pleasure.
And thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Caitlin of T with Tolkien,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Aja V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Johanna T,
Mike M,
Robert H,
Paul D,
Julia,
and Worty.
As well as those celebrating their patron anniversary in August, Tom M,
Jonathan L,
Henry B,
Austin B,
and Caitlin H.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you, Jonathan. Mm-hmm. And thanks to everybody for listening. We'll talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.